Hi there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and once again this week I'll be reading to you from Bruce Sterling's wonderful book, The Hacker Crackdown, Bruce's chronicles of the early days of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the fight for civil liberties on the internet. I'm reading this with the permission of the author, Bruce Sterling, who released the book for free, simultaneous with its publication, way back in 1992, making him a real pioneer. Well, I am back in London after 3 weeks on the road. I was here, as you may recall, for 1 week before taking off again. 1 week after I got home from China and Australia and Japan, I left again. I've been in Amsterdam for the Picnic Conference and then in Martha's Vineyard to teach the Viable Paradise Writers Workshop. And boy, did I have some great students this year. Really inspiring. And then I was off in New York for some editorial meetings, and then in South Carolina to speak at Calhoun College during National Cybersecurity Week, San Francisco to give a talk at the Zend PHP Con, and then to do a little consulting with a company there called IDEO that I have a long relationship with. And now I'm home, home again, home with my pregnant fiance and home with all the junk that the sea freight people dropped off when they came and dropped off all the stuff we'd shipped home from Los Angeles. I even got a roll of tape left behind that says, open for examination by Customs and Excise, from the United Kingdom Customs Service. I guess this got left in one of our boxes. So it's all here. Most of it's on the floor. Some of it's going into storage. Most of it's going to the thrift. Again, I think one of the best ways to figure out whether or not you really need something is to ship it halfway around the world and then try to find room for it. And at that point, I think it often is the case that you realize, gosh, I didn't need this stuff as much as I thought I did. Well, the trip that I was just on had many highlights, but possibly the best of them were the series of meetings I had with my publisher, Tor Books, in New York City. Tor wanted me to meet with a bunch of people regarding the upcoming publication of my kids' hacker novel, Little Brother, the book about hacker kids who win back the American Bill of Rights by fighting the Department of Homeland Security with superior technology. That book is coming out next May, and Tor is really, really, really excited about it. I had all these meetings with their senior sales reps, people who sell to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, the independent stores, the big Canadian wholesaler, H.B. Fenn, and we sat down. Most of them had read the book. We talked about how they felt about it, and we talked about the ways that I was going to promote it and things they could help use to sell it to their accounts and so on. This is really unusual, and it suggests an enormous amount of support for the book from the publisher, and I could not be more thrilled. I also, while I was there, got a chance to get a sneak peek at the cover designs, several of them. I snuck over to Irene Gallo's office. She's the art director for Tor and the woman who's been responsible for commissioning all those wonderful covers that my books have had. And she took me over to her designer's office, and he showed me just some of the neatest cover concepts I've seen, and every one of them was brilliant. I'm glad I don't have to make the decision. I'm hoping maybe we can even get a gallery of the rejects, and I can put that online as kind of alternative covers that people can look at. We also spent a lot of time brainstorming great ways that we could sell the book and promote the book and get the book into kids' hands. One of the things that we decided to do was to follow on the example of someone who was reported on on the great kids blog, Y-Pulse. What we're going to do is offer galleys of the book to high school newspaper editors, kids who edit their local high school's papers. And we're going to do that outreach through Boing Boing. So we're going to say, you know, are you the editor of one of these high school newspapers, or are your kids or siblings involved? Would you like a free copy of the book to review? This is, of course, the kind of thing that people do with, quote, real newspapers all the time. But those newspapers aren't read by kids, and I want this book to get into kids' hands. So we're going to do that. I'm going to be speaking at the American Library Association convention, and I'm going to be speaking to another conference of kids librarians, doing a lot of stuff to talk to these people. It's going to be great. So as I mentioned, I'm back in London, and I'm ensconced in my little office here in our flat. And very shortly, it will not be my office anymore. Very shortly, this is going to be our nursery. What exciting stuff. We're having a baby in January, and she's going to get my office, and I am going to go out into the wide world and get an office somewhere in town. Those of you who are Londoners, if you hear of anything going up for rent fairly centrally located, I really want a place with a door. I want my own little room with a door and a desk where I can put my bookcases and really call it my own. So if anyone hears of anything in London, I'd be eternally grateful. I really am looking. And I'd move in just as soon as I could. The sooner we get my stuff out of here and turn this place into a nursery, the better. Now, have I mentioned how good it is to be home? It is so good to be home. It's so good to have my suitcase under the stairs, to have my clothes unpacked, to have taken in my dry cleaning and all the stuff I tore over to the dry cleaners to have it mended, and to have really just to be sitting here in front of my computer with my big monitor, my keyboard, all those luxuries that I'd lacked. An external mouse, what a luxury! And to be able to just sit down in a real office chair at my real desk surrounded by all my interesting junk and just go to work. God, it feels great. Anyway, that's not why you're listening. You're listening to hear more of the Bruce Sterling book, and I'm here to read it to you. Without further ado, here is Bruce Sterling's The Hacker Crackdown. Other game designers were champing at the bit. Prominent among them was The Mentor, a gentleman who, like most of his friends in the Legion of Doom, was quite the cyberpunk devotee. Mentor reasoned that the time had come for a real cyberpunk gaming book, one that the princes of computer mischief in the Legion of Doom could play without laughing themselves sick. This book, GURPS Cyberpunk, would reek of culturally online authenticity. Mentor was particularly well qualified for this task. Naturally, he knew far more about computer intrusion and digital skullduggery than any previously published cyberpunk author. Not only that, but he was good at his work. A vivid imagination combined with an instinctive feeling for the working of systems and especially the loopholes within them are excellent qualities for a professional game designer. By March 1st, GURPS Cyberpunk was almost complete, ready to print and ship. Steve Jackson expected vigorous sales for this item, which, he hoped, would keep the company financially afloat for several months. GURPS Cyberpunk, like other GURPS modules, was not a game like a Monopoly set, but a book, a bound paperback book the size of a glossy magazine, with a slick color cover and pages full of text, illustrations, tables, and footnotes. It was advertised as a game, and it was used as an aid to game playing, but it was a book, with an ISBN number, published in Texas, copyrighted and sold in bookstores. And now, that book, stored on a computer, had gone out the door in the custody of the Secret Service. The day after the raid, Steve Jackson visited the local Secret Service headquarters with a lawyer in tow. There he confronted Tim Foley, still in Austin at that time, and demanded his book back. But there was trouble. GURPS Cyberpunk, alleged a Secret Service agent to the astonished businessman Steve Jackson, was a manual for computer crime. "It's science fiction," Jackson said. "No, this is real." This statement was repeated several times by several agents. Jackson's ominously accurate game had passed from pure, obscure, small-scale fantasy into the impure, highly publicized, large-scale fantasy of the Hacker Crackdown. No mention was made of the real reason for the search. According to their search warrant, the raiders had expected to find the E911 document stored on Jackson's bulletin board system. But that warrant was sealed, a procedure that most law enforcement agencies will use only when lives are demonstrably in danger. The raiders' true motives were not discovered until the Jackson search warrant was unsealed by his lawyers many months later. The Secret Service and the Chicago Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force said absolutely nothing to Steve Jackson about any threat to the police 911 system. They said nothing about the Atlanta 3, nothing about frack or night lightning, nothing about Terminus. Jackson was left to believe that his computers had been seized because he intended to publish a science fiction book that law enforcement considered too dangerous to see print. This misconception was repeated again and again, for months, to an ever-widening public audience. It was not the truth of the case. But as months passed, this misconception was publicly printed again and again, it became one of the few publicly known facts about the mysterious hacker crackdown. The Secret Service had seized a computer to stop publication of a cyberpunk science fiction book. The second section of this book, The Digital Underground, is almost finished now. We have become acquainted with all the major figures of this case who actually belong to the underground milieu of computer intrusion. We have some idea of their history, their motives, their general modus operandi. We know, I hope, who they are, where they come from, and more or less what they want. In the next section of this book, Law and Order, we will leave this milieu and directly enter the world of America's computer crime police. At this point, however, I have another figure to introduce. Myself. My name is Bruce Sterling. I live in Austin, Texas, where I am a science fiction writer by trade. Specifically, a cyberpunk science fiction writer. Like my cyberpunk colleagues in the US and Canada, I've never been entirely happy with this literary label, especially after it became a synonym for computer criminal. But I did once edit a book of stories by my colleagues called Mirror Shades, the Cyberpunk Anthology, and I've long been a writer of literary critical cyberpunk manifestos. I'm not a hacker of any description, though I do have readers in the digital underground. When the Steve Jackson Games seizure occurred, I naturally took an intense interest. If cyberpunk books were being banned by federal police in my own hometown, I reasonably wondered whether I myself might be next. Would my computer be seized by the Secret Service? At the time, I was in possession of an aging Apple IIe without so much as a hard disk. If I were to be raided by the author of a computer crime manual, the loss of my feeble word processor would largely provoke more snickers than sympathy. I'd known Steve Jackson for many years. We knew one another as colleagues, for we frequented the same local science fiction conventions. I'd played Jackson games and recognized his cleverness, and he certainly had never struck me as a potential mastermind of computer crime. I also knew a little about computer bulletin board systems. In the mid-1980s, I had taken an active role in the Austin board called SMOF BBS, one of the first boards dedicated to science fiction. I had a modem, and on occasion I'd logged into Illuminati, which always looked entertainingly wacky, but certainly harmless enough. At the time of the Jackson seizure, I had no experience whatsoever with underground boards, but I knew that no one on Illuminati talked about breaking into systems illegally or about robbing phone companies. Illuminati didn't even offer pirated computer games. Steve Jackson, like many creative artists, was markedly touchy about theft of intellectual property. It seemed to me that Jackson was either seriously suspected of some crime, in which case he would be charged soon and would have his day in court, or else he was innocent, in which case the Secret Service would quickly return his equipment, and everyone would have a good laugh. I rather expected the good laugh. The situation was not without its comic side. The raid, known as the cyberpunk bust in the science fiction community, was winning a great deal of free national publicity, both for Jackson himself and the cyberpunk science fiction writers generally. Besides, science fiction are used to being misinterpreted. Science fiction is a colorful, disreputable, slipshod occupation, full of unlikely oddballs, which, of course, is why we like it. Weirdness can be an occupational hazard in our field. People who wear Halloween costumes are sometimes mistaken for monsters. Once upon a time, back in 1939, in New York City, science fiction and the U.S. Secret Service collided in a comic case of mistaken identity. This weird incident involved a literary group quite famous in science fiction, known as the Futurians, whose membership included such future genre greats as Isaac Asimov, Frederick Pohl, and Damon Knight. The Futurians were every bit as offbeat and wacky as any of their spiritual descendants, including the cyberpunks, and were given to communal living, spontaneous group renditions of light opera, and midnight fencing exhibitions on the lawn. The Futurians didn't have bulletin board systems, but they did have the technological equivalent of 1939, mimeographs and a private printing press. These were in steady use, producing a stream of science fiction fan magazines, literary manifestos, and weird articles, which were picked up in ink-sticky bundles by a succession of strange, gangly, spotty young men in fedoras and overcoats. The neighbors grew alarmed at the antics of the Futurians and reported them to the Secret Service as suspected counterfeiters. In the winter of 1939, a squad of USSS agents with drawn guns burst into Futurian House, prepared to confiscate the forged currency and illicit printing presses. There they discovered a slumbering science fiction fan named George Hahn, a guest of the Futurian commune who had just arrived in New York. George Hahn managed to explain himself and his group, and the Secret Service agents left the Futurians in peace henceforth. Alas, Hahn died in 1991, just before I had discovered this astonishing historical parallel, and just before I could interview him for this book. But the Jackson case did not come to a swift and comic end. No quick answers came his way, or mine. No swift reassurances that all was right in the digital world, that matters were well in hand after all. Quite the opposite. In my alternate role as a sometime pop science journalist, I interviewed Steve Jackson and his staff for an article in a British magazine. The strange details of the raid left me more concerned than ever. Without its computers, the company had been financially and operationally crippled. Half the SJG workforce, a group of entirely innocent people, had been sorrowfully fired, deprived of their livelihoods by the seizure. It began to dawn on me that authors, American writers, might well have their computers seized, under sealed warrants, without any criminal charge, and that, as Steve Jackson had discovered, there was no immediate recourse for this. This was no joke. This wasn't science fiction. This was real. I determined to put science fiction aside until I had discovered what had happened and where this trouble had come from. It was time to enter the purportedly real world of electronic free expression and computer crime. Hence this book, hence the world of the telcos, and the world of the digital underground, and next, the world of the police. Part 3, Law and Order. Of the various anti-hacker activities of 1990, Operation Sundevil had by far the highest public profile. The sweeping, nationwide computer seizures of May 8, 1990 were unprecedented in scope and highly, if rather selectively, publicized. Unlike the efforts of the Chicago Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force, Operation Sundevil was not intended to combat hacking in the sense of computer intrusion or sophisticated raids on telco switching stations. Nor did it have anything to do with hacker misdeeds with AT&T's software or with Southern Bell's proprietary documents. Instead, Operation Sundevil was a crackdown on those traditional scourges of the digital underground, credit card theft and telephone code abuse. The ambitious activities out of Chicago, and the somewhat lesser known but vigorous anti-hacker actions of the New York State Police in 1990, were never a part of Operation Sundevil per se, which was based in Arizona. Nevertheless, after the spectacular May 8th raids, the public, misled by police security, hacker panic, and a puzzled national press corps, conflated all aspects of the nationwide crackdown in 1990 under the blanket term Operation Sundevil. Sundevil is still the best-known synonym for the crackdown of 1990. But the Arizona organizers of Sundevil did not really deserve this reputation, any more, for instance, than all hackers deserve a reputation as hackers. There was some justice in this confused perception, though. For one thing, the confusion was abetted by the Washington Office of the Secret Service, who responded to the Freedom of Information Acts on Operation Sundevil by referring investigators to the publicly known cases of Night Lightning and the Atlanta Three. And Sundevil was certainly the largest aspect of the crackdown, the most deliberate and the best organized. As a crackdown on electronic fraud, Sundevil lacked the frantic pace of the war on the Legion of Doom. On the contrary, Sundevil's targets were picked out with cool deliberation over an elaborate investigation lasting 2 full years. And once again, the targets were bulletin board systems. Boards can be powerful aids to organized fraud. Underground boards carry lively, extensive, detailed, and often quite flagrant discussions of lawbreaking techniques and lawbreaking activities. Discussing crime in the abstract, or discussing the particulars of criminal cases, is not illegal, but there are stern state and federal laws against cold-bloodedly conspiring in groups to commit crimes. In the eyes of police, people who actively conspire to break the law are not regarded as clubs, debating salons, users groups, or free speech advocates. Rather, such people tend to find themselves formally indicted by prosecutors as gangs, racketeers, corrupt organizations, and organized crime figures. What's more, the illicit data on outlaw boards goes well beyond mere acts of speech and/or possible criminal conspiracy. As we have seen, it was common practice in the digital underground to post purloined telephone codes on boards for any freak or hacker who cared to abuse them. Is posting the digital booty of this sort supposed to be protected by the First Amendment? Hardly, though the issue, like most issues in cyberspace, is not entirely resolved. Some theorists argue that to merely recite a number publicly is not illegal, only its use is illegal. But anti-hacker police point out that magazines and newspapers, more traditional forms of free expression, never publish stolen telephone codes, even though this might well raise their circulation. Stolen credit card numbers, being riskier and more valuable, were less often publicly posted on boards, but there is no question that some underground boards carried carding traffic, generally exchanged through private mail. Underground boards also carried handy programs for scanning telephone codes and raiding credit card companies, as well as the usual obnoxious galaxy of pirated software, cracked passwords, blue box schematics, intrusion manuals, anarchy files, porn files, and so forth. But besides their nuisance potential for the spread of illicit knowledge, bulletin boards have another vitally interesting aspect for the professional investigator. Bulletin boards are crammed full of evidence. All that busy trading of electronic mail, all those hacker boasts, brags, and struts, even the stolen codes and cards can be neat, electronic, real-time recordings of criminal activity. As an investigator, when you seize a pirate board, you have scored a coup as effective as tapping phones or intercepting mail. However, you have not actually tapped a phone or intercepted a letter. The rules of evidence regarding phone taps and mail interceptions are old, stern, and well understood by police, prosecutors, and defense attorneys alike. The rules of evidence regarding boards are new, waffling, and understood by nobody at all. Sun Devil was the largest crackdown on boards in world history. On May 7th, 8th, and 9th, 1990, about 42 computer systems were seized. Of those 42 computers, about 25 were actually running boards. The vagueness of this estimate is attributable to the vagueness of A, what a computer system is, and B, what it actually means to run a board with one, or with two computers, or with three. About 25 boards vanished into police custody in May 1990. As we have seen, there are an estimated 30,000 boards in America today. If we assume that one board in 100 is up to no good with codes and cards, which rather flatters the honesty of the board-using community, then that would leave 2,975 outlaw boards untouched by Sun Devil. Sun Devil seized about a tenth of 1% of all computer bulletin boards in America. Seen objectively, this is something less than a comprehensive assault. In 1990, Sun Devil's organizers, the team at the Phoenix Secret Service Office and the Arizona Attorney General's Office, had a list of at least 300 boards that they considered fully deserving of search and seizure warrants. The 25 boards actually seen were merely among the most obvious and egregious of this much longer list of candidates. All these boards had been examined beforehand, either by informants who had passed printouts to the Secret Service, or by Secret Service agents themselves, who not only come equipped with modems, but know how to use them. There were a number of motives for Sun Devil. First, it offered a chance to get ahead of the curve on wire fraud crimes. Tracking back credit card rip-offs to their perpetrators can be appallingly difficult. If these miscreants have any kind of electronic sophistication, they can snarl their tracks through the phone network into a mind-boggling, untraceable mess, while still managing to reach out and rob someone. Boards, however, are full of brags and boasts, codes and cards, and they offer evidence in the handy, congealed form. Seizures themselves, the mere physical removal of machines, tends to take the pressure off. During Sun Devil, a large number of code kids, wares dudes, and credit card thieves would be deprived of these boards, their means of community and conspiracy, in one swift blow. As for the sysops themselves, commonly among the boldest offenders, they would be directly stripped of their computer equipment and rendered digitally mute and blind.